Pushkin. From Pushkin Industries, this is Deep Background, the show where we explore the stories behind the stories in the news. I'm Noah Feldman. This week, we talk about France. When we Americans hear the word French, we often think that the next word is supposed to be revolution. In our imagination, France is a place where the revolution didn't just happen in 1789, but happens every so often ever since. Turns out the French think about themselves exactly the same way. Starting last November, protesters wearing yellow safety vests began to block rotaries and roundabouts all over France. And eventually they marched on Paris, where they talked seriously and threw stones and made a protest about a whole range of economic issues that were bothering them. The protests continued, and the French President Emmanuel Macron was required to take major steps in response. And since today is Bastille Day, the day that France celebrates as the recognition of its own revolutionary independence, we thought this was a perfect time to review the movement from beginning to end. To do that, we're joined today by Agnès Poirier, a French journalist based in the UK, who wrote a wonderful article about her uncle Jojo and his role in the Gilets Jaunes or Yellow Vest protests. Agnès, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
I want to ask about the concrete element of the metaphor of the yellow vest. What are they for? Why do the French carry Gilets Jaunes in their cars?
It's actually compulsory to have a yellow vest or high visibility jacket in your car in case your car breaks down. It means that you have to park your car as safely as possible, put on your jacket, leave the car, and then put yourself in a safe place.
So the upshot is that everyone who has a car has a yellow vest, making it a very simple thing to put on as part of a mode of protest, but it was also connected to the origin of these protests, which began with a tax on petrol or gasoline.
Yes, completely. Car drivers, basically, very angry at a carbon tax on petrol and diesel, started the movement, hence the yellow vest, probably. And also, you know, it's a metaphor. It's a kind of call for help. You know, you're putting your yellow vest because you want to be seen. You want to be seen in order to be helped. So in a way, it was very appropriate symbol, if you'd like, of their movement, at least when it started.
I wanted to ask about that petrol tax, the tax on diesel that started this, the carbon tax. Now, seen from the outside, that tax looked like France acting as a good global citizen, saying we're going to reduce carbon emissions in order to do our part to contribute to the reduction of global warming. All economists that you speak to tell you that the only realistic way to reduce carbon emissions is to tax them. And so the government of France decided under Emmanuel Macron to adopt such a tax. Were the protesters being anti-environmentalist in protesting this tax, or was there another nuance to it?
Well, actually, it came as the last straw, if you'd like, because it started early in the summer 2018, when the speed limit on French roads was reduced from 90 to 80 kilometers. And that enraged a lot of people in provincial France, if you'd like, especially people who rely on their cars to go about their day, to drop their children to school or to go to their work. Then there was a hike in petrol and diesel prices. Then there was also a more, if you like, compulsory measures for when you do an MOT, when you have to get a certificate that your car is in good shape, which you have to do regularly in France. And there have been more implemented just a few months later. And so that carbon tax was really the last straw. It was, I don't think on its own it would have created any movement in particular, but it came after a long series of measures that were deemed affecting primarily car drivers. And we're not talking about, you know, city dwellers. We're not talking about metropolitan France, if you'd like, people living in major cities or Paris, because they don't need to rely on their car to go about their day every day. We're talking about people in rural France, and they felt, you know, in a way targeted.
So in the first instance, this felt like an attack on drivers. And in the French context, that also means an attack on rural people, people who are not in the elite centers of the city and people who rely on their cars to get around. And indeed, the first form of the protest was to block roundabouts or rotaries, as we call them in American English, and block traffic from traveling through at all. And that, too, connected to the idea of freedom to drive. And it's as though the protesters were saying, if you're going to impinge on our freedom to drive, then we're going to impinge on your freedom to get around the country. Then the protests moved into the city and some began in Paris itself. Tell us about how that happened.
Well, protesters didn't come from, you know, the cities or Paris. They came to Paris on Saturdays, if you'd like tourists.
Mm-hmm. A day trip.
To protest. It was never a Parisian revolt. It was very much a provincial revolt. And you know, at the beginning, we used the words of Jacquerie, if you'd like, which is sort of peasants, the 17th century peasant revolts against a centralized power.
And those were typically driven by genuine starvation. I mean, that's the old precedent.
Of course. But it was also a revolt against the local elite, if you'd like. So The first yellow vest, if you like, when they started rallying on social networks and they said, okay, well, we need to strike. We're going to strike on Saturday, the 17th of November, 2018. That will be our first action throughout the country. And there were quite a lot of them. They were just under 300,000. I mean, by French standards, it's not enormous, but it's enough for the country to stop and to think, okay, what's happening here? And so those first yellow vests belong to what in Britain we would call the squeezed middle, if you'd like. That is to say, not destitute, not, you know, very poor people, not at all, but not rich either. And in France, it means a lot of people. We're talking about lower middle class, middle classes. People who perhaps are too rich to get, you know, a lot of benefits, not rich enough, obviously, to be able to afford living in places where they don't have to rely entirely on their car.
I mean, class consciousness and class politics are deeply embedded in the historical French story. But when one thinks about that historically, one doesn't think about the squeezed middle. One thinks about the rises of the peasants, as you described, in the pre-revolutionary period. One thinks about the rise of the bourgeoisie, which is a kind of rising middle class. One thinks about an aristocratic elite, or later a technocratic elite. But there hasn't been a central place, correct me if I'm wrong, in the long French narrative of class for people like you're describing. Is that so? And if it is, What's the French term that, or what language have French commentators or observers used to describe this social class?
I mean, you're right in the sense that it was novel, and it took time for sociologists, for demographers, to grasp the movements. And one of them actually said, "It's not a class; it's a mass."
What's the difference between those things?
In the sense that, for instance, if you take the age of the yellow vest, actually, you had people from the age of 17 to the age of 77.
So people from all ages.
All ages. Also, a lot of artisans, a lot of self-employed, also some entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. You know, that's why perhaps we'll talk about my uncle mm-hmm. later. But he's a self-made man, so it makes him, in a way, part of the people, if you'd like. Also, he doesn't come from the aristocracy. He comes from middle, lower bourgeoisie. So it was, you know, and a lot of men and a lot of women, a lot of also single parents and single mothers who had difficulty making ends meet. A lot of professionals from, you know, a lot of nurses, some teachers. So, you know, it was a mix, a very, very diverse mix. So it's quite difficult to apply the class system to it. And that's why also I resorted to a very English, as in British, term, the squeezed middle class.
Right. But you don't think it's an it doesn't exactly capture it. But I do have the sense from reading that most of the people who have come out for the protest do experience themselves as suffering from economic privation. It's not impoverished, but barely making it in some sense. And it seemed to me that that was why your story was so fascinating, precisely because your uncle didn't fit into that category.
No, he didn't. My uncle, Jojo, is in his 60s. He's well off. He was the CEO of a large European company, although he belongs also to, you know, a category of retired people who do have worries for their children and grandchildren, somebody who lives in the provinces, somebody who feels quite lonely and who discovered sort of fraternity on those roundabouts. And a lot of people started talking to neighbors they wouldn't talk to otherwise. So especially at the beginning of the movement, it was really striking to see that there was this fraternity, which is so French, and also given the very striking figure of cafes. You know, 60 years ago, there were 200,000 cafes in France. There are only now 36,000. In sharp contrast, the roundabouts didn't exist 50 years ago, and now we've got more than 50,000. So the roundabout became very much a place for conviviality. I mean, they built sort of canteen, you know, and tents, and they, you know, for weeks, because now the movement has disappeared from the roundabouts, but for weeks and months, they would converge and they would have their little commune and debating societies on the roundabouts.
So there, when you talk about fraternity, you're translating the French word fraternité, which for Americans means something like solidarity or a way of feeling some sense of connectedness to other people. And so you're suggesting, if I understand you correctly, that one thing about this particular protest movement is that it offered some opportunity for connection to people who might feel in certain ways isolated, and that they actually could take the roundabout or the rotary, which they had taken over, and make it for a Saturday into a place to hang out, a place to interact with each other, and a place to feel human connection, like you belong to a common project, which in French terms is a crucial element of national identity. It's one of the three big commitments of the French model.
Completely. And so we're talking about this mass rather than class of people who also feel, you know, underprivileged or vulnerable because they are lonely. A lot of single parents, a lot of lonely retired people, and, you know, living in isolation in provincial France, and often only having a relationship through social networks in front of their computer screen. And then suddenly they rekindled with, as you said very rightly, a very French way of life. Because those cafes that have disappeared through the last 60 years in France haven't disappeared from city centers.
There's still plenty of cafes in Paris. It's out in the countryside where you don't
exactly
have them
anymore. You know, in villages, there used to be many cafes, and now, you know, there's perhaps one left, but often there's none. So we're talking about a disconnection between part of France that is successful, young metropolitan, that travels abroad, that is a sort of the radiant face of globalization, just like President Macron.
Who is young, who is elite, who is sophisticated, who wears tailored suits, who is comfortable in multiple languages. He's the outward-facing picture of the modern French elite, and he's very far from the world of the small provincial town where the cafes have closed and there are jobs, but maybe not enough jobs for everybody.
Completely. And that's why also, I don't know if you remember at the beginning, this hatred, which we didn't quite understand because it was so, it came from the guts, you know, and this hatred against Macron, the figure of Macron, was to do with what he personified. And you're saying he's a symbol of the elite. Of course he is, because he's now the president. He's also very young. And somehow, they disliked that fact, if you like, because the Yellow Vests thought, rightly or wrongly, that they belong to the losing France, if you like.
So here it gets really, really interesting and also really complicated for outsiders to understand. So let's try to figure out a little bit the politics side here, because until now you've described very movingly, in fact, the sort of psychological experience of people who feel that the center doesn't care about them and that the elites aren't thinking about them. And that makes them sound extremely sympathetic. Politically, though, the movement did, as you've just described, focus on a kind of great anger at the French president and at the idea that his politics somehow stood for making France in some way more like the United States, more market-driven. Macron's first, you know, major reforms involved changing French law to make it easier for employers to fire employees, which has been very difficult under French law. That's a kind of market-oriented reform. And so the criticisms and the protests seem to take the form, in part at least, of an attack on this tendency of Macron's to be efficient, rational, and market-driven, and in that sense, distant from the more centralized, organized, top-down French system. Have any of the major French political parties that criticize Macron been able to capitalize on the movement? For example, has the French far right, which in some ways you would think would have shared a lot of the interests of the protesters, you know, peripheral, not necessarily from the center of Paris, appealing to people who aren't the poorest but are also not the rich elites. Has anyone been able to capitalize on the movement for political gain?
Well, it's the heart of the matter. Right from the start, the far right and the far left and their respective leader, Marine Le Pen for the far right and Jean-Luc Mélenchon for the far left, try to surf on the wave of the Yellow Vest. They appeared with them, they put on yellow jackets, but the Yellow Vests didn't want to be associated with them, at least to start with. They were a leaderless movement. But the problem, of course, is when you constitute a movement, there's a moment when you need leaders. But each time they elected leaders, they were disowned, they were rejected. And when the government said, why don't you send your representatives so that we know what you would like, so that we can stop the violence on the Saturday protest and we can start talks, they didn't send anyone. So it's never became anything else than a rebellion, if you like. One very interesting thing is that a lot of Yellow Vests, when you met them, said, I have never voted in my life before. But more importantly, a lot of them said, it's the first time we take to the streets. So it's true that we're talking about politically disenfranchised citizens. And the far right and far left were very eager to capitalize on the Yellow Vest anger. And they failed. They completely failed. There were, at the latest European elections, two Yellow Vest sort of lists people could vote for, and they got 0.5% of the vote between the two. So in a way, it's the death of the Yellow Vest rebellion, because they never managed to become anything else.
That's completely fascinating in its own right. The idea that a movement had a desire to be heard, that the participants had a desire to be known, that they rejected, again, in a sort of inspiring way, the idea that they could be co-opted by either the far left or the far right. But then there's something that seems almost tragic about the idea that the movement simply peters out and gets close to dying by virtue of the fact that they've been heard. They've said their piece. The whole world has looked at them. The whole world has paid attention to them. France has paid attention to them. But they have they fundamentally changed anything? Have they changed the perspective on politics of any of the players, even if they haven't ultimately, you know, joined? Is there going to be a long-term effect on the language or the ideas of French politics?
We're talking about, you know, people here in France who asked for more public services, and less taxes. How do you square that circle? You know, nobody can. And they also wanted a kind of direct democracy that is, in my view, the opposite of democracy. For instance, they said, oh, we want to bring down the government. We want Macron to resign. We don't want to have a national assembly anymore. We just want direct democracy. We'll just vote on the internet, you know, through Facebook or whatever, on laws. You know, we should have a system of referendum, for instance, for every single idea. I mean, things like this. The yellow vest are a symptom rather than, you know, giving any answers to an anger. It's a feeling. And they certainly didn't come up with any possible rational political recipes or ideas that could be later implemented.
But is that asking too much of the movement to be, if they were rational politicians, they would form a political party and they would, you know, participate in electoral politics, or they would be journalists or commentators or, you know, political scientists sitting in a seminar room and offering theories. That doesn't sound like what the movement was trying to be.
Well, we still don't know what they were trying to be, because in a way we're still focusing on the early stage of the Yellow Vest movement, because perhaps we should also say that the Yellow Vest became extremely violent.
Let's turn to that. And was the movement hijacked, as some people say, hijacked by thugs or anarchists from the right or the left?
Yes, completely. Professional anarchists, professional thugs, which are very well known in France and come from the extreme right and the extreme left. And so we're talking only about people who are sort of insurrectional. And at some point, you know, there was I was in Paris and I was present during the Saturday protest, and there was a sort of insurrectional perfume in the air of Paris. But of course, they were never, they didn't have the number, if you like, to stage a coup, because that's what they were calling for.
So I like the idea of an insurrectional perfume. It sounds like insurrection would be a great name for a new Dior perfume. But what does that mean? Do you mean that feeling in the air as though, let's go burn it all down?
Oh, yes, completely. Look, I'm in my early 40s. To take to the street is part of it's a rite of passage for any mm-hmm. French citizen. I've been to countless demonstrations in Paris, and the level of violence I experienced in the streets of Paris during the Saturday Yellow Vest were unlike anything we seen before. And even people who were old enough to attend 1968 demonstrations in Paris said the same. You know, simply because they wanted to kill, when I say they, the thugs that infiltrated the Yellow Vest or some of the Yellow Vests, wanted to destroy and to also kill policemen if they could. And 2,000 policemen were actually injured, which is a very high figure for France, because don't forget, we have mastered the art of demonstration. We know how to do this. It's very theatrical.
Yes, everyone has a role. Everyone knows what to do so that things don't get out of hand.
Completely. And it can appear violent, but it's actually quite safe. Or it used to be until the Yellow Vest, because the Yellow Vest was about, really, very quickly on, became about violence and pure violence. Even the police, the riot police, was struck by that. They actually didn't know how to react the first few Saturdays. Sometimes they were too passive and they were completely, you know, out of their depth, if you'd like. And a lot of destruction took place of buildings, but also some protesters were hit by rubber bullets, which is a non-lethal sort of riot control guns that the French police is allowed to use. But so there were a lot of injured, a high number of injured, but nobody died. And that's a miracle, because the violence we all have seen in the streets of Paris was unlike anything we had seen in decades.
Did the violence ultimately contribute to the discrediting of the movement?
Completely. I mean, that's why the real yellow vest, if you like, the people who really had something to say and had perhaps, you know, wanted to be helped by the government. And in the end, they were. Actually, I think we should say that President Macron actually gave 17 billion euros worth of different benefits and tax incentives and bonuses and cancelled the carbon tax. I mean, he went much further than the original demands of the Yellow Vests.
I mean, that goes to the question of the long-run impact of the movement. It did have, at least in the immediate, some of the movement's demands, even if they were inchoate, were in fact met.
Oh, met and further than the original demands, because in France, that's the way it is. When the people take to the streets in numbers, the government always responds. If you want a bit of history, we have to go back to the French Revolution. The legitimacy of the power in France lies with the people. Okay, in Britain, it lies with the parliament. It's a question of history.
Or it used to.
Yes, it used to until Brexit. That's another story. But so to go back to France, you know, the people is the power. And as a French citizen, you know, you have this power and you play with it. But the violence, to go back to your earlier question, meant that a lot of the early Yellow Vests decided they had nothing to do with violence and the violent people, and they stayed at home. So from 300,000 people, we very quickly went to, 20,000?
So there was a natural trajectory, as it were. The people, or some of the people, expressed themselves. They said they spoke on behalf of a broader people. The violence discredited the movement. The government responded. And then, as if on cue, the movement began to recede in numbers, perhaps having achieved the goal of drawing attention to the problems of the people who marched, but without offering a permanent kind of a solution.
Completely. And also the fact that the few Yellow Vests that tried a sort of democratic exercise of presenting themselves at the European elections failed so lamentably, you know, is the kind of end to the movement, yes.
A kind of coda. Thank you, Agnes. That was very, very fascinating. And I really, really appreciate your time. I look forward to reading more of your work going forward.
Thank you.
It's with great love and admiration for France that I note that only a French person would describe a day of riots and protests in Paris as a day when there was a perfume of insurrection in the air. Yet the truth is, there's something very powerful and significant about the trajectory of the Yellow Vest protests, which tells us something not only about France, but about the way that populist movements all over the world express their anger, express their demands, and ultimately still have difficulty turning them into concrete long-term political action. That's something that I think we should watch not only in Europe, but everywhere in the world, including right here in the United States. Populism is our constant refrain. It's in the news every day. But populism that isn't transformed into long-term political movement is just the expression of emotion. It clarifies, it expresses, but it doesn't fix things. It's one of the most powerful impulses in all of our political lives. It's also one of our most dangerous.
Deep Background is brought to you by Pushkin Industries. Our producer is Lydia Jean Cott, with engineering by Jason Gambrell and Jason Rostkowski. Our showrunner is Sophie McKibben. Our theme music is composed by Luis Guerra. Special thanks to the Pushkin Brass, Malcolm Gladwell, Jacob Weisberg, and Mia Lobel. I'm Noah Feldman. You can follow me on Twitter at Noah R. Feldman. This is Deep Background.